Do not jest.
Sodja frowned. Her dark hair was disarranged and damp with sweat. She shook the strands out of her face.
I didn't intend to, my lord. Together we made a daughter so clever and capable that she was chosen to be a queen's talon at a younger age than any other. Your true wife cannot make such a claim, although she treats me as if she birthed Nazero, and I only order supper for you.
Enough, said Vieki.
Why did everyone seek to trouble him today?
We will speak of this no longer. Our laws come from the garden itself, and are not to be disputed. If anyone hears you speak this way, you will die in pain, and there will be nothing I can do to save you.
Sodja fell silent. Vieki nodded his approval. Mortals, even the cleverest ones, were like the birds of the meadows, chattering and piping at all hours. But this one still charmed him, he had to admit. Even as the first signs of her mortality began to show on her face and body. Even in the brief bloom of her youth, she had never possessed anything like the icy beauty of his wife Kimabu, but something in her had drawn him from the first. Sodja's youth was fading now, in the same way the end of summer taught the edges of the leaves to curl. But the thing that had drawn Vieki, the thing that even now he could not name, still burned in her every glance, every movement.
Is it that mystery itself that fascinates me? He wondered. Or the terrifying pleasure of something stolen, something forbidden?
After all, if any of his underlings saw him this way, talking freely with a mortal animal, as if she were the equal of a Hikideya, they would denounce him immediately.
Thus the problem with climbing to a great height,
he thought, weary already, and with the true ordeal still ahead.
All the more can look at you with envy, and the height of the waiting fall grows with each upward step.
He rose from her bed and began to dress.
I will miss you, my lord, she said. My days are lonely.
He ignored her. She always said such things after they coupled. He did not know how to respond, any more than he would if his warhorse or hunting owl should speak to him the same way. When he had pulled his robe tight and belted it, Vieki patted himself to make sure he carried no weapon or other implement forbidden to the queen's visitors. He wholeheartedly approved this ban, but it also seemed a bit foolish. After all, who would be so mad as to dare attack Utuku, the ever-living? And not only because of the constant presence of her personal guards, the queen's teeth, the finest warriors in Nakika. No, the most daunting of all Utuku's defenses was the queen herself. Nobody living could even guess at the limits of her power. The Hikideya's immortal monarch inspired the reverence of all her people. But she inspired fear as well, and in even the most potent of her underlings. Vieki was still annoyed with Sodja for her irresponsible questions. He left her rooms without the usual sentimental exchange she so valued. The royal summoner's torch bobbed before him, serving more as a ritual banner than a source of light. Trailed by his secretary, Yemon, and a small contingent of his household guards, Vieki followed the messenger up the great open stairway toward the third tier and the palace, past the dimly glowing expanse of the White Gardens, which stood on a high stone island midway between the tiers. Vieki had always found the fungus gardens soothing. Once he had even brought Sodja to see them, but instead of understanding, his mortal concubine had been disturbed by the forest of snaking, dead white stems, the delicately spreading fans and huge parasol caps that nodded in even the smallest shift of air. She had told Vieki they made her think of writhing worms in a shovel full of dark, moist earth, and had pressed him to take her out again after only a short time. He had been disappointed, almost irritated, at her inability to recognize the sublime beauty of the place. But Sodja was only a mortal, after all. Small wonder she saw death and decay in everything. Still, Vieki would have given much to be walking in those gardens now, even with an unappreciative companion. As the royal messenger led them upward, an almost imperceptible breeze lifted a cloud of spores that drifted to the summons party and swirled with every step they took. He found himself recalling what the poet Loya had written about this very spot. When Earth Star and Snow Tongue send up their seed, I walk the naked night, constellations dancing around my feet. More than a dozen great years had passed since Loia's death. Almost 8 mortal centuries. But what she had written of the White Garden was still true. The unchanging nature of Nakiga was its greatest beauty. As they drew closer and closer to the palace, uneasy thoughts followed Vieki's every step like Sun Yasu's beggars. He wanted to believe this summons was only part of ordinary protocol, the awakened queen summoning her highest ministers to an audience. But Vieki knew that he had greater crimes on his conscience than simply reading forbidden verses. He had colluded with his master Yarike and others to hide the things they had done while Utuku slept. What did it matter that they had acted for what they believed was the good of the Hikadeya people? The queen was not merely power, she was justice itself, the spirit and conscience of the race. How could he stand before her and not confess everything he had done or had even thought of doing? And if he did, how could his punishment be anything less than the end of honor and the utter destruction of himself and his family?
"Breathe and grow calm, Vieki Se Endoya," he urged himself. "You are a noble of the Hikadeya and a child of the sacred garden. Even if death itself awaits you, do you wish to meet it like a cowering child?"
High celebrant Zuneyabe stepped up to meet him as Vieki entered the palace's front gate. At first it seemed an honor that ancient Zuneyabe had come himself, instead of sending an underling. But today the masked high celebrant did not speak a word to Vieki, only made a ritual gesture of respect before signing for him to follow. Vieki showed no reaction to this ominous silence, of course, but only made a sign of assent and let the masked Zuneyabe lead him. A guide through the royal palace was always necessary for visitors, although that guide was seldom anyone so elevated. The Omiya Hamak was a maze in truth as well as in name. An unfathomably complicated puzzle of carved chambers and corridors, of slender bridges and apparently pointless staircases that led nowhere. A vast mystery that could never be untangled by chance alone. Only the highest celebrants knew their way to the heart of the labyrinth, where the queen waited. As Venerable Suniyabe led him deeper and deeper into the maze, Vieki could only think of who had summoned him, of who sat waiting at the heart of this web of stone.
"Utuku, the eldest, the mother of all, the heart of our race."
The honorifics he had learned in childhood presented themselves to his fretful mind one after another.
"Wise beyond wisdom, strong beyond strength, immortal, all-seeing."
At last they reached a corridor full of doors, each as plain and unprepossessing as the rest. Suniyabe paused and laid his gloved hand on Vieki's sleeve.
"Now I leave you," said the high celebrant,
any expression hidden behind his ivory mask. He pointed to one of the doors.
She waits.
Zuniabe made a courteous but abbreviated bow, then turned away. For perhaps the half-dozenth time since leaving his house, Vieki commended his soul to the garden.
Begone, beggars,
he commanded the useless, plaguing thoughts, as he opened the door and stepped through into shadows.
Didn't the old hero say that one is only truly alive when death is close?
The darkness behind the door was not as complete as he had first thought. A single torch burned at the far end of a corridor, a featureless stone. Above a door as simple as the one he had just entered. For a moment he mistook the row of unmoving figures on either side of the hallway for statues. But then he saw they wore the unadorned, face-hiding helmets and snowy white armor of Atuku's personal guard, the Queen's Teeth. These were no stone carvings. Unmoving silence was their ordinary state. Vieki's father, Orayeki, was a court artist, always sober and correct with his noble subjects, but more high-spirited at home with his family, and on occasion almost fanciful. When Vieki was a child, his father told him that the Queen's Teeth were actually the spirits of warriors who had fallen in the Queen's defense, their bravery earning them the privilege of guarding her for all eternity. Vieki had eventually learned the truth, but the memory remained. And though they might not be spirits, none except for those in the highest precincts of the maze and the Order of Sacrifice knew much about the teeth, how they were chosen and trained, where in the great palace they were housed, or even any of their names. A drunken commander of sacrifices had once told Vieki that the Queen's elite guards surrendered their tongues to the knife during the ceremony when they donned their sacred helms of white witchwood.
What a world it must have been when witchwood was so plentiful,
Vieki thought, as he passed between the rows of silent, helmeted sentries. Little of it still grew, and the sacred groves were now all but empty.
Only the Queen herself remains undying and unchanged. Everything else that belongs to the people falls away, grows slack, crumbles to dust.
As he reached the end of the corridor, the door there opened, though none of the guards had moved and no one stood behind. Vieki stepped across the threshold, back into space and light. Faces. They were the first thing he saw, spread across every wall of the vast chamber and stretched across its ceiling as well. Huge faces, some staring nobly, some grimacing in agony. And every face belonged to the same person. Vieki had seen those features 1,000 times on monuments and murals. He knew them as well as those of his own family. It was Druki, the White Prince, the Queen's martyred son, who stared at him from all directions. Most of the portraits rendered in Srinyedu, a sacred weaving art that the Hikideya had brought with them from the garden. Though even the tile floor displayed different moments of Druki's foreshortened life. In the middle of the chamber, under the eyes of all those weeping, suffering Drukis, a spherical, filigree frame surrounded a massive bed, both supported by a single plinth of black stone. And at the center of the bed, like an egg waiting on a nest, sat the silver-masked form of Atuku herself. Vieki was in the Queen's own state bedchamber. Shocked, nearly witless by this realization, he dropped to his knees so quickly that he hurt himself against the hard floor, then pressed his head down on his hands in a pose of utter subjugation. He waited, eyes closed, but when someone finally spoke, the voice was not the Queen's.
"Greetings, High Magister Vieki. You are welcomed into the presence of the Mother of the People."
Still face down, Vieki clenched his teeth. He knew those harsh tones all too well, and he did not like hearing them now. What was Akinabi doing here, alone, of all the queen's ministers?
Her Majesty speaks, and we all obey,
Vieki replied carefully.
Her Majesty spoke, and I obeyed.
Rise, Magister, said the Lord of Song. No need for excessive ceremony. The queen does not wish it.
All thanks to the mother of the people, he said, and thanks to you for your welcome as well, Lord Akinabi.
Vieki climbed to his feet, but still avoided looking too directly at the slender, shrouded white figure on the great bed. The High Magister of all singers made an easier, if more unpleasant, object for his attention.
You may address the queen,
Akinabi instructed him, as though Vieki was some new-minted acolyte.
You are permitted.
It was all Vieki could do to turn toward his ruler, though he still could not gaze at her directly. His heart was racing like a stone bounding downhill. He had been elevated to High Magister during her long sleep and had never met her face to face. He had not thought he would be so overwhelmed by the queen's presence. But every childhood story, every bit of his people's long history under her rule, had suddenly risen inside him like a flood and swept away his other thoughts. What did it matter what he believed or intended? Vieki's entire existence belonged to the mind behind that shining, imperturbable silver mask. His life was utterly hers. How could it ever be otherwise? Still, he could not help noticing that the mother of all seemed a surprisingly small figure in the great bed with its spherical canopy of filigreed witchwood. Despite its great size, the canopy was as delicate as fine jewelry, as boldly beautiful as a ring of ice around the moon. Vieki realized after a little discreet study that it was meant to resemble the porous casing around a witchwood kernel. And by that shape, he then realized, the canopy announced that the queen herself was the key in, the holy witchwood seed from which everything else sprang. The beginning of the Hikadeya people, as well as the source of all their race's gifts. Small wonder this was where she held audiences with her servitors. That seed of all growth, the ageless queen, reclined on cushions in the center of the bed, her lower half covered by blankets. As always, Utuku wore mourning colors, gown and gloves and hooded cloak of icy white. But the eyes that stared at him from the holes in her shining mask were as dark as the emptiness between stars. She was staring at him, Vieki abruptly realized, and he was staring back at the mother of the people. Horrified by this accidental effrontery, he pressed his forehead against the tiles once more.
I offer the garden 1,000 thanks every day that you have returned to us, Majesty.
An ivory mantis in a cage on the queen's nightstand turned its head at Vieki's sudden movement, then resumed cleaning itself. The silence stretched. At last he looked up, stilling the urge to blurt out more praise and more thanks, because that would suggest weakness or guilt, both bad things to show before the queen. At last, Utuku nodded, a tiny dip of the head that was the first movement he had seen from her. Her words when they came were not spoken from her mouth, but leaped directly into his thoughts like molten metal poured into his ears, abrupt, shocking, and painful.
When you walk long enough in the wastelands of sleep,
the queen said,
you discover that the stars are eyes.
Vieki had no idea what her words meant.
Yes, O mother of all. The queen is still not entirely well after her long sleep, Magister Vieki.
Akinabi's harsh voice sounded more amused than anything else. But as always with eldest, whether the queen, the Lord of Song, or one of their shrinking number of peers from the earliest years after arriving here from the garden, it was impossible to guess what was hidden by the masks they all wore. Where the queen's features were forever hidden behind smooth silver, Akenabi concealed his face behind a wrinkled, nearly translucent tissue of pale leather, covered all over with tiny silvery runes. The whole stitched directly to the Lord of Song's own skin at the sides, mouth, and the holes for the eyes. Whispered rumors said his mask had been the living face of one of Akenabi's rivals.
With the help of my singers, the mother of the people is recovering swiftly from her great exertions in the War of Return. May she live forever in glory,
Akenabi continued.
But the welfare of our race cannot wait for the queen's full health. So neither will she. She wishes me to speak to you about the projects your builders have begun in the lower levels. I am honored to make my report to our beloved monarch,
Vieki said with a small revival of confidence. If the queen wanted to know about his work, perhaps this was not his day to be punished after all.
As High Magister Akenabi can confirm, Great Queen, we are expanding the city on Nakiga's lower levels to make room for all the new slaves and half-blood workers.
He spoke with a certain satisfaction. He and his order had worked hard for their queen and their people during her long sleep.
200 of my builders lead the effort, commanding 1,000 mortals, and almost half that number of Tinukadeya, carrymen, delvers, and others. We will finish in time for Druki's day.
Enough, said Akenabi abruptly.
All this detail is meaningless, because the queen commands the work to stop now.
For a moment, Vieki could draw no breath.
But we,
he began.
Do you dispute with the queen, Magister?
No, never. I would not dream of it,
he said, struggling to find words.
But so much work has already been done. That is unimportant, Magister Vieki,
declared the Lord of Song.
The mother of all has different employment in mind for you and your order.
Vieki watched his most important undertaking as High Magister, the greatest source of his pride, crumble away in a moment, as though some foolish apprentice had struck at the wrong floor in a stone facing.
Of course,
he said after a pause to collect his startled thoughts.
Our lives are hers, always. Queen Otoko is pleased to hear that,
said Akenabi.
Because while our monarch was deep in the Keta Yendra, some of her nobles made decisions that are rightly reserved to the mother of all alone. Rebuilding the old city outside the mountain gates, for instance, or taking mortals as concubines, simply to create more children, more half-blood children.
Vieki felt an icy fist close on his heart.
In fact, Her Majesty was astonished to discover all that had changed during her Yendra,
Akenabi went on, his voice carefully pitched to show his contempt for any who would try to alter the queen's will.
Things never done since the 8 ships landed had been ordered in her name while she slept. Yes, Magister, her queen is unhappy, very unhappy, especially with any nobles who made these decisions while claiming the good of all as their reason. But in fact, to benefit their own bodily lust and greed.
Of course, the Lord of Song himself had been involved in every decision he now recited. But Akhenaben had not lived to be the queen's oldest and most powerful courtier by taking the blame for mistakes. Vieki was beginning to believe his execution might be the purpose of the audience after all.
So does Akhenaben intend to sacrifice me to preserve his own life with such his unwitting excuse? But if I am given to the Hamaka torturers, I know things about the Lord of Song himself that Akhenaben might not wish the queen to hear. Could he only be warning me, then? Might he even be reminding me?
The thought was bizarre but compelling.
That we have common cause, a need to protect each other's secrets now the queen is awake.
In the midst of so much strangeness, this seemed perhaps the oddest idea of all, that Vieki might be forced into permanent alliance with the Lord of Song. His old master Yarike had been right. There was no stranger mistress than power.
"Das, Magister," said Akhenaben sharply. "You can see why, with so many other unwanted changes revealed to our beloved mistress upon her awakening, the queen does not wish to see her order of builders laboring for the greater comfort of slaves. Our race will not dwindle without them, or the half-breeds that treacherous nobles have forced upon us. The only thing our beloved queen has not decided is whether some of these mistakes were honest ones, or whether they were all attacks on her sovereignty. Do you grasp this, High Magister?"
"Of course," Vieki said. "I am grateful that she has shared her thoughts with an object as humble as myself."
"Good! And the queen wishes you to summon back those builders who are working to shore up the old walls as well. All your order will be given new labors."
This was even more surprising than ending the expansion of the slave quarters. The old walls and their guard towers were some of Nakiga's best defenses against the mortals, and all of them were badly in need of repair.
"I am not certain I understand," he said carefully. "Do we speak of the walls around Greater Nakiga? The walls that surround our old city and territory outside the mountain? Because while the queen slept, the murdering Northmen won their way to our very doorstep, precisely because those walls were in disrepair. But now we have almost made them safe again."
"You waste time just as your workers waste efforts on those useless walls, builder."
Akhenaben pronounced the order's name with scorn.
"The queen says we no longer need to protect ourselves from the mortals."
Vieki was astonished.
We do not?"
"No."
The singer's voice grew harsher.
"Soon, the mortals will need to protect themselves from us instead. The most recent war of return is not over, but this audience nearly is."
Akhenaben spread his gloved hands in a signal that demanded attention, but Vieki was so stunned by his words that he could not have spoken if he wished.
"The queen commands that all building in the lower levels and that the outer walls of Nakiga must stop. You will see to that personally, Magister Vieki. Later, you will receive word of what new works your order will undertake. Is that understood?"
It did not appear he was going to die, or at least not at this moment. But beyond that, Vieki could scarcely grasp what he had just been told. Was this a plot of Akhenaben's to snatch even more power? Did the magician only pass along the queen's wishes? Did Utuku truly mean to go to war with the mortals again? or did he somehow press his own ideas in her name? Akhenaby was subtle beyond Vieki's understanding, but surely the Lord of Song knew how hopeless such a war would be. Even with the new generation of half-breed warriors, the Hikadeya were still vastly outnumbered by the Northmen on their borders, let alone the rest of the mortals in all their ugly, wasp's nest cities scattered across the known world.
"I understand," was all he said out loud. "I will do whatever my queen wishes, as always, and I thank her and the Sacred Garden for her confidence in me. One last thing that our beloved mother of all wishes to make clear," declared the Master of the Singers. "From now on, the queen commands that all mortal-breathing women will be kept in the lower-level pens with the rest of the slaves, unless needed, and then returned there afterward. Do you hear this, High Magister?"
Vieki could only nod.
"Good. The queen's confidence in her noble ministers, like her love for her people," said Akhenaby, "is wonderfully deep, but not endless."
A door opened in the wall. Akhenaby glanced at it, then back to Vieki. The meaning was clear. Vieki bowed and said,
"We all sleep until the queen wakes us,"
then performed his rituals of leave-taking before backing out of the vast white bedchamber. Outside, his thoughts as disordered as if he had taken a bad fall. It was all he could do not to stumble down the palace stairs and corridors like a drunkard. He could make no sense out of what had just occurred. Did the queen truly know what was happening? Or did she still wander in dream while only seeming to have wakened? Was Akhenaby an enemy or an unlikely ally? And was Vieki really meant to send his favorite, Sodja, out of his household entirely? Most disturbing of all, what on earth could the Lord of Song have meant by saying, "The war of return is not over"? Were those merely words meant to inspire? Then why abandon the work on the outermost walls? Vieki had feared many things from this audience, but had not imagined confusion as its main product. His household guards and his secretary were waiting for him outside the palace gatehouse. Yamon could have no idea what had happened during his audience, but recognized that his master's thoughts should not be interrupted, so he accompanied Vieki all the way back to the residence in silence. Neither did he ask any questions when they were finally through the doors of the house itself, because Vieki left them all suddenly and without further orders, shut himself in his study and latched the door behind him. His wife, Kimabu, could not rouse him when she was preparing to go to bed. Vieki told her loudly and angrily to go away. And much later, when Sodja knocked softly at the study door and called to him, the mother of his child received no answer at all. 6. An Aversion to Widows. Even several days after they had departed her Nisadak, the queen was still angry. Spring was coming on quickly, even as they travelled farther north. The snow reduced to patches upon the open meadows, in treetops, and on the upper slopes of the hills. The breeze carried warm hints of grass and flowering things. It all should have made for a pleasant ride, but Miriamel could not shift the mood that had seized her. "Your Majesty looks a bit fierce," her husband said. "Frightening, a lesser man might even call it." Simon was only trying to amuse her, she knew, but she was not in the mood.
"If you must be told, I am still furious with that preening, giggling bitch, Tilith."
"Then you think she is a real danger?" Simon's look said he truly wanted to know. Miri felt a sudden wash of gratitude that she had found such a man. One who cared what she thought, because he trusted her and loved her, not because of the crown on her head.
Could I rule with any other? I cannot imagine such a world.
If she were merely some chattering magpie of a courtier, Hugh was betting, no,
I would not, she told him. But she has him wrapped around her finger.
And you heard what ALS said?
Witchcraft!
Simon frowned. The two of them were riding a short distance behind the vanguard. For once they had the chance to speak privately.
Perhaps, but even so, don't be so quick to put all the blame on her, he said. Hugh has changed since I first knew him, and not for the better.
Doubtless, but you didn't speak with her as much as I did. Although not for lack of the woman trying to get you to notice her.
Simon frowned.
Do you think so?
Think so? Blessed Elysia, she was all but rubbing her bosom against your arm when they showed us around, sliding against you like a cat in heat.
I did not notice.
You don't convince me. How could any man fail to notice that woman's breasts? She was all but carrying them around on a cushion and calling them the crown jewels.
Simon grinned, and for a moment was a boy again.
Well, then, you're right, my dearest. I did notice. It embarrassed me, because I knew you were looking. I promise you, I care nothing.
That is not the point. Don't be thick.
Ah, wife, you still retain your power to charm me.
Stop!
I won't be put off by your good mood. That woman frightens me. Even Enawen, gentle Queen Enawen, calls her a danger. She is trying to raise demons, as Priorates did.
Both of them had almost met death at the Red Priest's hands. She knew Simon would not pass over it lightly.
Yes, yes, I heard everything Aelair had to say.
Simon shook his head.
But we already have plenty of other problems, my dear. And Hernestia may be under the High Ward, but they are also a kingdom in their own right. What should we do? Seize the king's mistress and put her on trial for trying to raise demons? Aedonite rulers passing judgment on pagan nobility for witchcraft? Many of the Hernestiri are already chafing at being ruled by foreign Aedonites. We might as well send in the questioners of the Sacred College.
Don't blind yourself, Simon, she said more harshly than she intended.
Not everyone means well as you do. You are too naive sometimes. Please don't treat me like a child, Miri.
For the first time, her husband's equable mood soured.
Don't instruct me as if I was still a scullion, not after all these years.
After that, they rode for a while in silence. She was sorry to have scolded him, but not enough to apologize. Her husband's inclination to trust was part of the reason she still loved him so powerfully. But that didn't mean she was wrong. Mirimel had already conceived a deep dislike of Hugh's intended before Aelair had told them of his conversation with Queen Enawen. Certainly, Lady Dilith's easy familiarity, as if Mirimel, a queen herself and the daughter and granddaughter of kings, were nothing more elevated than an elder sister, had set her teeth on edge. But the woman also seemed amused by everything going on around her. Not like Miriamel's dear friend Rona, who genuinely could not help finding things funny, but in the superior way of someone who treasured a secret that everyone else would be shocked to know. Hearing about Enawen's fears had only solidified Miriamel's own concerns. Still, Simon was right about one thing. The High Throne had many other problems, more tangible and more pressing. The horrible mess of the Northern Shipping Alliance's near war with the old meddler Count Strawway's daughter, the Countess of Perdruin, had the potential to throw trade into chaos up and down Austin Ard, to name only one. But as she thought of such things, Miri found a core of sadness inside herself that had little to do with the affairs of state.
It was hard. Being away from home on his birthday, she said,
the first words either she or Simon had spoken in some time.
I did not expect it to be so hard after all this time, but it was.
her husband accepted the offered peace. "For me too, my dear. I sometimes feel like a cat." He saw her look and smiled sadly. "I mean, old Shem the groom used to say that he had to watch the stable cats carefully, because if they had a small spite, a rat bite or wound from another cat's claws, all would seem well and healed on the outside, but the wound would still be festering under the skin. Sometimes it would kill them weeks later, when they seemed to have been long past it."
"Now that's a lovely, reassuring thought," he flushed.
"I meant only that grief, that sometimes we have not healed as well as we thought, my love." She saw that she was doing it again, biting at him when she most needed their old companionship. The thing that bound them together from the very beginning as surely as the love they later came to feel. The subject of John Joshua especially brought it out in her, as though her husband somehow bore the blame for that agonizing loss, instead of being another victim.
"I'm sorry. You're right. It is hard sometimes. I thought it would be easier as the years went on. I suppose most of the time it is. But when it isn't..."
"I try to remember all the good that came from his life, cut short though it was. I remind myself of the good things we still have. Morgan and Lilia."
"Do you count the widow, too?"
He smiled, but there was a pained twist to it. "Adela is the mother of our grandchildren, and I don't think she is as dreadful as you sometimes paint her.
John Joshua should not have married so young, and he should not have married her."
"He loved her. No one could talk him out of it, Miri, you know that."
"But we were his mother and father. We should have..."
This time she swallowed the words before they could come out, then violently expelled her breath.
"All the saints, give me strength! I cannot bear to hear myself!"
She bent forward in the saddle and ran her fingers through her horse's mane, trying to distract herself. She saw Ayala riding a short distance away, close to them now, but not too close.
"Everything seems sad or frightening to me today," she told her husband. "Iskrimnor, John Joshua's birthday, and that mad, rude performance in Hernestia. You treated us like unimportant old relatives, and spending 3 days with that witch he's going to marry only made it worse. Demons or no demons, that Tilith probably killed her husband, you know. People certainly think so."
"People think many things. Often they are wrong." This time Simon's smile looked a bit foxy. "Perhaps you simply have an aversion to widows." She glared, but she knew it was only a jest.
"There is Eole. Ask him to tell you again what he thinks of her, and what Queen Enarwen thinks."
She said it loudly enough that the hand of the High Throne looked over to them, his expression carefully empty.
"Did you call me, Majesty?"
"You have been riding beside us for a while, good Count," she said. "I can see you are waiting for us to stop talking."
"I do not want to trouble your majesties or interrupt your conversation." "Call it saving us from ourselves, then," said the king. "Miri and I are both out of sorts. Come, ride here beside us and tell us what's on your mind."
Ayala looked at Miri, who nodded.
"Very well, then," he said. "I have had a messenger from Hernisadark just now. Pasavali's dispatch came after we had left, so Hugh sent it on by fast rider."
"Very kind of him," said Simon flatly. Ayla was the last man in Ostenard to miss something simply because it was unspoken.
"Majesties, I still do not know what King Hugh was thinking, to keep you waiting at the gate," he said. "I apologize again on behalf of all my countrymen for such strange, discourteous behavior. Queen Anarwen was surprised and shamed that the king kept you waiting so long outside the walls. She told me so."
Simon waved his hand.
Enawan is kind, she always was. I am not too troubled. Men are men, whether king or kitchen worker, as I should know better than anyone. Hugh may be a bit overexcited by his own grandeur, as well as by the prospect of marriage. As for Lady Tillith, Simon had just noticed the halves of the broken seal that bound the folded papers in Aelair's hand. Well, enough of her for now. What does Lord Chancellor Passivalis have to say? Do you not want to read it yourself, Majesty? I know you too well to think you would have broken that seal if the letter was not addressed to you, good Aelair. And I also know you will have read it carefully, and probably more than once, because you are someone who never has time for clean hands, as my old taskmistress Rachel the Dragon used to say. So please, tell us what is on Passivalli's mind, or at least the things we need to know. Miriamel nodded. When they were young, and the fact of their sudden power was like a waking dream, Simon had tried to be all things to all people, unable to refuse a favor or to turn his back on a cry of need. Miriamel, raised in her father's courts in Merrimond, and then the Hayholt, had already known that a monarch who could not stand aloof sometimes was a miserable monarch indeed. It had taken years, and the elevation of several old trusted friends to the most important positions in court, but her too kind husband had finally learned he could not be all things to all people. Aelair undid the flattened roll, and as Miriamel had expected, immediately found the first thing he wished to discuss, several pages in. He prepared for any and all of his duties, no matter how small, with the anguished care of a general outnumbered and at bay. After much talk about the dedication of the new chapter house and the work on the library, as well as a few other matters I will save for later, like the League's complaint about Yasola's latest outrages, as they deem them, the Lord Chancellor gets to the business at hand. Aelair's rueful smile pulled his strong, weathered features into a droll face, and Miriamel remembered when she had thought him perhaps the most handsome man in all of Ostenarde. I do wish our friend Passivalis could be persuaded to put the most important business at the beginning of the letter. But he still writes like a child of a provincial court full of flowery greetings and formal phrases, even in a dispatch. Aelair's eyes widened a little. Forgive me, Majesties. I did not mean to sound as if I was criticizing the Lord Chancellor. He is an able man and a fine administrator. Simon laughed. You need not worry. We know you admire him. Indeed, your Majesties are lucky to have him, and he will take good care of the Hayholt and Erkin land in your absence. But you were not so certain of that when we made the decision to travel to Rimmersgard, were you? Simon said. Come, I am teasing you, old friend. I know you are only doing your duty. It is a difficult thing to take away the king and queen from their court for so long. But we should get back to the business of Passivalli's letter. Let me just read this to you, said Aelair, moving the heavy parchment until he found an appropriate distance from his eyes. But, my gracious lords and lady, I fear the news from your great southern duchy of Naban is not so good, he began. He can be a bit wordy, our Passivalis, can't he? Simon remarked when Aelair had finished.
But the essence is clear enough, said Miriamel. Duke Saluceris is struggling more than ever with his brother, and Drusus, as always, is champing at the bit to push the boundaries of Naban farther out into the Thrivings. And the rest of Naban, also as usual, is waiting to see which of them wins the contest, as though it were no greater matter than a horse race.
Drusus claims that he wants only to protect Nabene settlers from raids by the Thrivings men, said Aelair. But that is the substance of the discord, yes, your Majesty. I will summarize the rest of Passivalli's points.
He believes the desire to push out into the grasslands is too strong among the houses of Naban's dominiate, and in the country as a whole, for Duke Salusaris to openly forbid his brother these aggressive actions. And he is also not certain that the Duke could survive an open struggle with Drusus in any case.
Does he truly mean survive?
Asked Miriamel, alarmed for the first time.
Surely, these are mere disagreements. The Benedrivine house is the house of Camaris the hero himself, and Salusaris is the lawful Duke of Naban, not just by their own laws, but under our ward. By the love of the saints, Simon and I crowned Salusaris ourselves in the Sankelen Edonitis, in front of God and all Naban.
All true, said Aeolair. And I do not imagine Drusus would move directly against his brother and flout so much law and custom. But assassination, if it could not be directly laid at Drusus' door, would still make him the next duke, since Salusaris' son is still a child. I hate to say so, but as your majesties know, murder has long been a favored method of gaining power in the south. Simon made a frustrated noise. Well, this is a puzzle and no mistake. But what can Miri and I do? It would be heavy-handed to send troops to Salusaris when he has not asked for such a thing. He looked around at the column of armored men marching behind them, and the vanguard of mounted knights. Not that we have any troops to spare just now, with the planting season hard upon us. Maybe Duke Osric is right when he says we need a larger standing force. After the king had paused long enough that it was clear he had finished his thought, Count Aeolair gracefully took charge of the conversation once more. Let me be clear, Majesties. Lord Passavalles does not ask you for a solution at this moment, but merely wishes you to know what the news from Naban tells him, so that any change will not come as a complete surprise.
In other words, said Miriamel, he wishes us to share his worry and his helplessness.
Aeolair frowned just the smallest bit. I'm afraid that is often a loyal subject's duty in such cases, my queen. Miri knew she was being unduly cross, but the sun and the spring scents she had hoped to enjoy were fading beneath all these fretful shadows of statecraft. You look as though you are thinking hard, my clever wife, said Simon. You have been in Naban far more than I have, and your family is still powerful there. What should we do? Miriamel shook her head.
Clearly my Nabene kin are busy adding fuel to the fire, almost certainly for their own purposes. And I would not trust my cousin Dallo Ingadaris, even to hold my reins for fear he would steal my horse. But there are still many other Ingadarines I trust. I'll write to them and see how things appear from where they sit, and whether the fight between brothers is as dangerous as Passavalles suspects.
We've already heard enough of this Drusus to think ill of him, Simon said. He's an arrogant, troublesome fellow, no doubt. But surely one man cannot provoke an entire nation into war by himself. It seems unlikely, said Aeolair. But stranger things have happened. In any case, as your majesties pointed out, we cannot send troops when they have not been requested. The Nabene would rightly resent it. And this is only one letter. Passavalles is from Naban himself, so perhaps he feels its storms more strongly than the rest of us would. But when we return, well, perhaps greater attention to Naban would not go amiss. They are a numerous and often quarrelsome people. I beg the Queen's pardon if I offend. After a moment's silence, Miriamel said,
Offend? No, Aeolair, I say it often enough myself. But we've barely begun this journey, and already I see troubles growing everywhere.
The sun, though its beams still sparkled on patches of snow, and the sky was empty of clouds, seemed to have grown dimmer.
I wish we were home.
We all feel that way, my love, Simon told her, at least at times like this.
He who always steps on sand, why did you lead your child to such a strange place?
The gods of Tiamat's childhood in the Ran were nowhere near as powerful and ever-present as the deity his employers worshipped. But there were times he couldn't help thinking that a little closer oversight from them might still be in order, especially on this royal progress into cold northern lands. He pulled his cloak tighter. He would never become used to drylander clothes, but he was inexpressibly glad to have the right sort of garments for these chilly northern lands instead of what he had worn in the first part of his life, seldom more than a breech clout and occasionally a pair of sandals. Even thinking about what it would be like to cross into frigid Rimmersgard in such near nakedness made him shiver, although several of the riders nearest him had taken off their helmets to enjoy the early spring sunshine.
Sunshine, he thought. Back in our swamp, no one would have called such thin gruel sunshine. It is not hot enough here to lure even a cold turtle out onto a rock.
It was not that Tiamat missed his marshy home, exactly. Even in Village Grove he had been an outsider, a strange young man who had learned to read and write, and had gone to Ancis Pelopé in Perdruin to study, an actual city. But he missed the security he had felt as a child in the swamp, beneath the spreading branches and heavy leaves, when everything had been known and familiar. Now it seemed that the more years passed, the more strange the world became.
Not too many years from now, I will truly be old, he thought. Will the world be completely strange to me then?
Tiamat had never been this far north before. That was part of it. Not only the cold air, but the very size of the sky seemed foreign. The broad expanse of blue so wide that he almost felt as though he stood atop some terrible high plateau, instead of on a broad plain of streams and snow-dotted meadows. But the snow was finally vanishing with the warming days, Tiamat reminded himself. He should remember to say a prayer of thanks. At the same time last year, as his comrades never wearied of telling him, this part of Osten-Ard had been hip-deep in swirling, mounding snow, the skies grey as lead.
So that is a good place to start with my gratitude, he told himself. Thank you, he who bends the trees. Thank you for any sun at all, and not too much snow.
He might have felt differently, he suspected, had they not been called north by such a sad circumstance, the imminent death of Ducas Grimnor of Elritsharle. Had it been anything less, though, he would probably not have accompanied the king and queen, but its Grimnor had been Tiamat's friend as well. Along with Miriamel, who was then only a young girl, they had faced impossible, almost unbelievable odds together, and survived. That alone would have obligated Tiamat to travel to this unsettling part of the world. But over the years his friendship with his Grimnor had become something more, something completely unexpected. The sulphurous duke, big as a house, as he had first seemed to Tiamat, had proved to be as wise as he was loud, and as subtle as he was brave. They had stayed in touch by letter, only a few per year stowed in the diplomatic posts that passed between Elritsharle and the Hayholt, but enough to keep the friendship very much alive. And in fact, for most of that time, it had been a three-part friendship, because Isgrimnor's wife Gutrun had always carefully gone through her husband's letters, adding in the words the duke had forgotten in haste, correcting the occasional woeful mistake of grammar. Isgrimnor was equally bad in his native Rimmersbach, she had often told Tiamat, and adding her own comments full of useful news and funny stories about her husband. The news of Gutrun's death several years ago had been one of the saddest days of Tiamat's life. He had spent very little time in her actual company, but in her husband's letters, peeping out from between his scrawled lines, she had made a home for herself in Tiamat's heart,
It was so hard to lose her, he thought. And now the Duke. Why does she who waits to take all back wait so long? Why must the reaping wait until we have grown so used to the world, when the pain will be sharpest for both the dead and their survivors?
Tiamak adjusted himself on the hard carriage seat. He had not become so much of a northerner now that he liked to ride a horse, nor was he large enough to comfortably ride one for long, even if he wished. He had a donkey they kept for him in the stables back home, an unpleasant but reasonably steady creature named Scand. But there was no question of Tiamak riding the beast on this trip, where it would struggle every moment to keep up with the horses. Instead, the little man sat beside the driver atop the carriage meant for the king and queen. Not that they had used it yet, as anything more than a moving cabinet for their clothing and other belongings. Back at the hayholt, Tiamak only rode Scand when he wished to be outside, and almost always in the company of young Princess Lilia and her pony. The royal granddaughter was nearly as pig-headed as the donkey, but Tiamak loved her in a way he would never have imagined possible, more even than he had loved his sister's children, as much as if she had been of his very own flesh. It was not solely his loyalty to Simon and Miriamel that made it so. Tiamak liked the heir, Prince Morgan, well enough, but there was something about the little girl that pulled and tugged at his heart. And when she called him Uncle Timo, he was quite helpless. Even if there had been anything left for him back in the Ran, even if the elders there had begged him to come back and be their chief, Tiamak knew he might not have been able to leave the little girl behind. He wanted to watch Lilia grow, see that clever mind fill with more and more understanding, watch her learn to put that powerful ambition to some higher task than simply forcing her slave uncle Tiamak to build complex water wheels for her in the mud of Kinswood streams. But losing Iskrimnor or missing little Lilia were not the only sources of Tiamak's discomfort. When the news came to the hayholt about the Duke, Tiamak had just begun his great work. Planning it had been the work of years. But instead of seeing it finally come to fruition, he was here, 100 leagues away from the castle, and weeks from returning, knowing his work had all but stopped in his absence. "And I am no longer young," he thought sadly. "Who knows how much time I have to complete this sacred task?" It was only a library, most people would say, a collection of books and scrolls, the kind of thing as Grimnor himself might well have thought a strange waste of space and time. But it was to be the first true open library ever built in the northern lands. And to Tiamak, who as a child had wondered if he might ever own a real book, it meant the world. Conceived to honor Miriamel and Simon's late son, Prince John Joshua, the unfinished library was already precious to Tiamak, who had cared for that young man very much. John Joshua had loved books and learning as much as the Ranna man did, and he had ambitions to make it a great center of scholarship in the young prince's name. "But until we return from Rimmersgard, I can do nothing to aid the work, except send the occasional letter to the Master Mason and pray for patience." A sudden gust from the faded blue mountains to the north pimpled Tiamak's exposed skin, and although the wind had been blowing all day, the strength of this chill surprised him, pushing deep into his very substance, bones and innards. Without even thinking, he made circles of his forefingers and thumbs to repel bad luck, as he had done when he was a child. "If I were back in Village Grove," he thought, "I would be certain that she who waits to take all back had just breathed on my neck, reminding me that she has plans none of us know about." Which was true, of course, as it always was. He was letting sadness over Iskrimnor make him fretful, jumping at shadows, cringing from sharp breezes. While Tiamak was trying to gather back together his hopeful thoughts about the library, he heard someone come riding swiftly up behind him. He looked down from his high seat to see one of Ayla's servants pacing the carriage on a tall, dark horse.
"Your pardon, Lord Tiamak," the rider said. "The Lord Steward bids me give you this. It came with the dispatches from Erkinland."
Tiamak looked it over as Ayla's servant rode away, and his heart lightened a bit. He knew who it was from instantly, because of the odd seal pressed into the red wax. Instead of a heavy metal stamp or a signet ring, his wife, Thalia, always pressed a small dried flower into the melted wax. Because she had sent the letter several months back in Feyver, she had chosen one of the first wildflowers that bloomed in Erkinland every year, a bright yellow bloom called Sunlion, or sometimes Colt's Foot. He knew she would have picked it herself as she gathered herbs and simples in the castle gardens, and it should have warmed him just to see its sunbeam petals, still bright despite its long travels. But he was still feeling the effects of the chill that had surprised him a few moments earlier. He unfolded the letter and began reading, hoping for good news or at least an absence of anything worrisome. Her opening words were in her usual conversational tone. Thalia seemed interested only in sharing various workaday matters, a few decisions on the library materials she hoped he would be able to write back about, and a question about wild marjoram and what he knew of its use in his boyhood home in the Ran. But then he reached the final paragraph.
"One last thing, my patient husband, a small but odd and interesting tale. I was called in your absence to practice physic on one of the kitchen workers. An old fellow of Ernestiri blood who had fallen into a fit on the floor of the battery. I do not know if you know him. His name is Regan, and he is a thin, gnomish fellow, 80 years old or even more, with large, bleary eyes and rough skin. He was not badly hurt, but his command of the Westering tongue is poor. So I asked Countess Rona to help me. She asked him in his own speech what had happened, and he said, 'I hear the Moriga talking to herself every night, and I cannot sleep.' Countess Rona looked a bit startled, I thought, and told me the Moriga was an ancient Ernestiri goddess of death and battle, no longer worshipped among her people, but still feared. Still blamed for nightmares and other foul things. Then before I could ask another question, this Rican said something else in that tongue. And this is what I thought would interest you. His words were, 'She summons us back. She summons us all back. She is the silver-masked mistress of tears.' Now I ask you, husband, does that not sound as though the Norns' queen Otuku, once a real living menace to all mankind, has somehow become a demon fable for kitchen workers? The city friends of the king and queen thought her power was utterly destroyed when the Storm King was defeated. And I pray that is true. If she is now nothing but a legend, a fading nightmare, then I thank our merciful God for preserving us all from her evil. I did not want to spend long with the man Regan once he seemed recovered, because he disturbed me more than a little, with his strange face and goggling fish-like eyes. And it was also disquieting to see calm, wise Countess Rona look so pale at hearing the name of the Moriga, the mother of all demons, as Rona named her. My Aedonite sisters would call this man's malady the work of the devil. But my learning has been so shaped by yours, dear Tiamak, that I suppose it instead only the confusion of an illness of his mind with tales he might have heard in childhood. In fact, I deem it proof of what you always say, my wise husband. Truth and falsehood walk a long way together before they go their separate ways."
Had he received her message just a few days earlier, Her tale of the kitchen worker's fit would have been a mere curiosity, to turn over in his spare moments. But instead, this story of a madman who dreamed of the Norn Queen made Tiamak feel like a traveller abroad at night who hears something following him through the trees. On the night the royal party had left Hernesteer, Count Eolair had told Tiamak and the king and queen of Queen Enarwen's worries about Lady Tilith, that she and some of the courtiers were worshipping the terrible ancient goddess, the Marriga, and now here was that name again. It has to be chance, Tiamak told himself. Eolair himself had said that stories of the goddess were as old as Hernesteer itself. But even as he soothed himself, his earlier chill returned, and this time without any cold wind to blame. The silver-masked mistress of tears. A deep dread clutched at his heart. Something is coming that will threaten all, he thought helplessly. My library, the royal children, the throne. I can feel it. He took in a long, shaky breath, his heart fluttering behind his ribs like a trapped bird. The driver flicked his whip to keep the horses together, oblivious to anything but the jingle of harness and the thump of hooves. The sky was still blue overhead, the sun still shone. But Tiamak felt as though he had stepped on what should have been solid ground, and found nothing beneath him but yawning emptiness. 7. Island of Bones. The other four members of the Queen's Hand sat silently on the beach below, waiting for the ship to come. They had already waited on the graveled strand for hours, still as statues, while the wind strengthened and the afternoon died with the sun, and would likely sit that way without moving for many hours more. But Nezeru had never before seen the ocean. She had been so taken by its immensity, its vitality, its ever-changing surface and colors, that she had climbed the cliffs above the isolated beach to get a better view. It was not only the size of the ocean that fascinated her, astounding as it was. The snowfields north of the great mountain back home seemed equally boundless. It wasn't the colors either, as magnificent and unexpected as they were. The startling jade translucence of the waves, the greys and blues and blacks and ragged white caps, because to Hikadea eyes the great ice fields of the Norn Fells were full of color, too. No, it was the aliveness of the sea that stunned Nezeru. The constant motion in different directions, the intersection of wave against wave that could turn water into weightless froth and throw it high into the sky. And it was not just the water itself that was alive. Seabirds rose and sank on every swell, or drifted above the waves in rotating clouds, their squawking cries filling her ears, filling the sky. Most of them were hunting the silvery fish that sparkled in almost every wave. Life was everywhere. Nezeru knew that if she gathered a sack of Naki Gabbali the size of a house, and dumped it onto the snowy ground outside her mountain home, not a thousandth of this array of living things would come to it. There would be crows, a few waxwings, and with nightfall the rats and mice. But the land around Nakiga could boast nothing like this chaos of noise and movement. She crouched on the hilltop and watched the sun dive down toward the sea, where it tipped the waves with copper. As the last sliver of the day star dropped behind the horizon, it flashed green. And as that moment came and passed, Nezeru happened to look down at the cliff face beneath her feet. Something pale sat only a few arms' lengths below her, shining in the day's last light. Nezeru did not hesitate, but swung herself over the edge, and then let herself down the steep rock face, testing each hold before giving it her weight, because the sandstone cliff was old and crumbling. In moments, she was dangling by one arm and balancing on the ball of one foot beside a bird's nest and its lonely occupant, a single, pale, brown-spotted egg.
A seagull's nest,
she decided, as she examined the frowsy accumulation of sticks and feathers and mud. Few gulls made it all the way inland to Lake Rumia beside the great mountain, but those who did were of keen interest to the Hecadea and their servants, whose diets were always limited by the bitter cold and frosty ground of their native land. Nezero knew very well both the look of a seagull's nest and the taste of the birds and their eggs. She carefully lifted the speckled thing, testing its weight. It seemed early in the year for egg-laying, but there was no question that something warm and alive slept inside. For a moment, she considered taking it. Hand Chieftain Mako was very sparing with food, but after hours standing atop the cliff, Nezero felt almost like a guest in this place. Also, the nest held only one egg, which made it seem something to be admired rather than used. It was an odd feeling, one that most of her training refuted, but Nezero gently set the egg back down in the nest. The light was waning as she climbed back up the cliff, the sky above her bleeding its violet into growing black. She paused to look out to the west where the sun had sunk, and the last light of day was fighting and failing. Far out on the horizon, so distant it would have been invisible to less keen eyes than those of the Hecadea, she saw the pale geometry of sails. She glanced down to the beach, but felt certain that the approaching ship must still be hidden from Mako and the rest. As she scrambled to the top of the bluff, pleased to be the one bringing news, a swirl of air brought the sharp and sudden smell of danger. Nezero peered above the edge. A boar had appeared, out for its evening forage. It was unaware of her, at least for the moment, but she knew that ignorance would not last long. At first she thought it must be a large male, since it looked to be at least 3 times her own weight, with viciously sharp tusks as long as her fingers. But the scent and the time of year suggested it was an older sow, in which case it was probably protecting piglets and would be especially aggressive. Worse, to make climbing easier, Nezero had left her sword and bow with her pack down on the beach. As she pulled herself onto more or less level ground, she slipped her knife from its sheath, although it didn't give her much confidence. A dying boar pierced by a heavy spear could still drive itself on sturdy, strong legs up the shaft towards its attacker and rip out a hunter's guts before collapsing. Nezero had killed before, and not just animals, but wanted no part of this if she could avoid it. This creature had not sought her out. It might have young to protect. Still, the stink of the sow was powerful, even against the prevailing ocean breeze and its blend of complicated smells. If the creature had recently farrowed, it might not accept anything less than a fight to the death, or Nezeru's running for her life, and a sacrifice did not run. Especially not one of the queen's talons. It saw her.
It will swing its head side to strike with those tusks, she thought. My knife is not long enough to reach its heart, but a well-aimed thrust might take it in the eye.
Before she had time to finish the thought, the boar scrambled toward her, back legs shoving hard against the loose cold dirt, grunting and squealing as Nezero dodged its first lunge. It turned on her again with such surprising quickness that she had time only to leap up and put her hands on its shoulders, hard bristles digging into her skin as she vaulted into the air. The boar threw up its snout to catch her as she went over, swinging its great head. The muddy tusks missed Nezero's belly by less than a hand's breadth. She landed and spun, knife out. The boar moved sideways, doing its best to keep Nezero trapped against the edge of the precipice. Vegetation was so sparse here that she knew if she was forced over the edge she would find nothing to grab, nothing to arrest her fall, all the way down to the stony beach. Still, leaping over the huge beast had barely worked the first time. If she tried it again, her belly or her leg might well be torn open by one of those deadly ivory scythes. She quickly checked the distance to the cliff's edge behind her, then crouched, knife extended now, tracking the boar's head from side to side.
Nezeru decided she would go for the animal's eye. Or perhaps, if she was lucky and avoided the first slash of the tusks, make a quick attempt to rip open the belly or the throat.
"Are you sure you want this, little mother?"
she asked.
"I would not take your life, except in defense of my own."
The angry red eyes gave no hint of similar sentiments. The wild sow shook her head and let out another grating bellow. An instant later, the huge pig was thrown sideways to the ground, as if struck by lightning. It let out a shrieking squeal that sounded like the terror cry of a thinking being, then began to crawl unsteadily away toward the undergrowth, dragging a long spear shaft through the bloody dirt. Kemi, one of Nezeru's fellow sacrifice warriors, strode forward and set his booted foot on the sow's ribs to yank his spear free. The boar screamed again, and its legs kicked, but he seemed to have torn a hole in its guts, and the animal's last struggles ended quickly. He wiped the head of his spear on the bristling hide, then looked up at Nezeru with poorly hidden distaste.
"The ship is here," he said. "Chieftain Mako orders you down to the beach."
He set his spear on his shoulder, turned, and walked away without a second glance at the twitching animal.
"But what about the boar?"
said Nezeru after a moment, when her surprised swirling thoughts had turned back into words.
"We have enough to eat."
Kemi was clearly displeased to have to explain himself to a younger sacrifice.
"A war hand, especially one made up of the queen's talons, does not drag food around with them as helpless mortals do." "But there will be mortals manning the ship," she said. "Surely they can find some use for the meat."
She did not know if she could carry the dead beast down the hill by herself, but she was willing to try. It was better than wasting it. Kemi did not even bother to look back at her.
"Leave it,"
he said. The ship was anchored far out in the bay. As Nezeru reached the bottom of the cliff a few paces behind Kemi, a longboat rowed by a half-dozen bearded men was already nearing the beach. She had no real fear of mortals, but simply seeing so many of them together lifted her hackles. The Han chieftain Mako was speaking with Abby Kay of the Order of Echoes, but Nezeru kept her distance, in no hurry to be reprimanded for dallying on the hilltop. She was wondering where the fifth member of their hand had gone, when she felt a presence behind her, as though someone or something was about to touch her. She whirled, drawing her knife again. The blade stopped an inch short of the half-blood sow Medge's throat. The magician did not blink or lift a hand to defend himself, but his pale lips curled in an expression that might have been amusement.
"We could not find you," was all he said.
Unlike the rest of the Talons, the singer did not wear his cloak with the black side out, now that they had left the snows, but continued to wear the white as proudly as if he were in the singer's order house back in Nakiga. For someone who was as much of an outsider as Nezeru was, Sao Meji never seemed to fear setting himself apart from the rest of the company.
"Thank you, and brother,"
she said, making her words as neutral as possible. She was determined not to give him undue respect, although she feared him as she feared all his order. No, it was because she feared him that she would give him nothing.
"I was only atop the cliff, watching for the ship."
Sao Meji held her gaze. He had strange golden eyes, though his skin was as white as that of any pure blood. Traitor's eyes, they were called back in Nakiga, because the eyes of the Scythi, the Norn's kinfolk, were that same color, though the two tribes had been gone their separate ways for a very long time. Such ancient features were scorned among the Hikadeya, even though they predominantly occurred in the oldest clans. As another half-blood, Nezeru wondered how much Sao Meji had suffered for having a mortal parent. Even to ask him, though, would be to create a kind of intimacy in which she had no interest.
As she and Saomeji joined the others, Marco stared at her so hard it made her uneasy, his eyes as unfeeling as a hunting eagle's. Nizero had admired him since she had first joined the Order, and had always done her best to emulate his pure-mindedness and his mask of stony indifference, but she feared that no matter how hard she tried, the human side of her heritage would keep her from being accepted by him or the others as true Hikadeya. Half-bloods were plentiful now in Nakiga, and they always matured far more swiftly than their pure-blood counterparts, though they seemed to live nearly as long. Nizero had become a death-sung sacrifice at an age when her untainted peers were scarcely ready to join an order, let alone be granted its highest honors. But the confidence of the insider could never be hers. She was half-mortal, and her father, though important, was not even of the Order of Sacrifice. Only deeds could overcome such a heritage and lift her out of the crime of her diluted blood. The rowers pulled their longboat up onto the strand. Like most mortals who lived near the ocean here in the north, they looked to be of Rimasgard blood. But unlike their kinfolk farther south, who had long ago given up the seafaring life, these so-called Black Rimmer's men still made their living upon the water, trading along the coast and even harrying and robbing any ships of other nations that strayed too far out of safe southern waters. But that was not the only reason these people were scorned by their Rimmersgard kinsmen. The Black Rimmer's men had been bound up with the Hikadeya for centuries. Many of them captured and kept like animals, forced to labor for their Hikadeya masters. Slave or free, though, they were usually hated as turncoats by their own mortal kind. At a sign from Marco, the queen's talons climbed silently into the boat, and the staring, clearly frightened mortals rowed them out to the waiting ship. The captain of the Hringleit, a grey-bearded mortal with a face browned and cracked by the elements, tried his best to act as though these passengers were nothing unusual. But Nizero knew that there had been little direct contact between the coastal lands and Nakiga since the end of the Storm King's War decades ago. These mortals might even have convinced themselves they were no longer the Queen's slaves. Until Marco and the rest of the Talons appeared in the coastal village and demanded passage to the outer northern islands. The thought filled Nizero with sour amusement. The captain certainly seemed to know these waters well, because they sailed through the night. As the dark hours passed, and Nizero watched, the stars wheeled across the sky overhead in their familiar constellations. The gate, the serpent, the lantern, and the owl. As if they had come to remind her that no matter where she voyaged, she was still beneath the protection of the garden. When morning came, the land had utterly disappeared, and everything beneath the grey sky was water. Nizero slept for a while without closing her eyes, letting her thoughts drift. She rose back to awareness to find the sun higher in the sky, but still far from its noon prominence. A short distance away, her chieftain Marco was sharpening his witchwood sword, Cold Root, against a polishing stone. She had watched him do it 100 times since they had left Nakiga in the previous moon. And still it fascinated her, the rigor of his attention, the unshakable sameness of his actions. The sword was well worth the care, of course, a blade of impeccable lineage. Fellow sacrifice Kemi had once told her in tones of veneration that it had belonged to a brother of Ekimeniso himself, the queen's revered but long-dead husband. More recently, it had been wielded by one of Marco's nearer kin, General Sonoku, the beloved hero who had died in the Nakiga siege. Nizero did her best to watch without too much obvious staring. It was a very bad time to break their leader's attention. Marco had slapped Ibi K's face once for coughing when Cold Root was unsheathed. As she watched the chieftain's long, pale fingers moving across the blade, she found herself almost falling into the pattern of the witchwood, its grey lines like whorls on a fingertip, so delicate as to be almost invisible. Each witchwood sword was as individual as its wielder. The pattern of the grain differed with each tree. Even discounting ornament, no witchwood sword would ever be the same as another. They were rarer than ever now, since witchwood itself was ever more scarce. Ezeru had